This podcast is a presentation of UCTV.tv, University of California Television. Like what you learn? Help others discover UCTV podcasts by leaving a comment or rating in iTunes.
And last but not least, give me great pleasure to introduce Dr. Nora Tarot. Needs very little introduction. You all know Nora. Nora is an internationally renowned hepatologist, a great mentor for many of the fellows and also junior faculty here, and is the director of our Hepatitis Center at UCSF. Really enjoying unprecedented success. And one thing I'd like to mention is that many of you may not know that Nora is the has the longest tenure now at UCSF among all the hepatologists. After Dr. Bissell retired last year. So by popular demand, Nora is going to finish today's session with hepatitis C, a disappearing disease. And you have to...
Thanks very much, Francis, for that introduction and for reminding me how long I've been at UCSF. No, but it's been a good time, don't worry. So this is, you know, I every year sort of seem like I have, it seems to get more and more exciting, I think. I love this title, actually. Francis thought of this title, and I think it's a great one. And it really was, I think, prompted by late last year. This was somewhat after our last meeting where our first all-oral therapies became available for hepatitis C. And it's really sped up the way that we think about doing treatment of our patients. We now have therapies that are really well tolerated by patients. Most of the drugs have no or minimal drug-drug interactions, which was really a challenge with our first-generation PIs. And we now very consistently can achieve suppression of HCV RNA on treatment and, as I'll show you, having also very high rates of sustained virological response. It's been an amazing transition. We very, very quickly have left interferon behind. And now with all orals, we still have a few challenges. And one of them is that we still are using ribavirin. I will show you data that says we are not ready to let it go yet. And ribavirin brings with it its set of side effects that most of us would like to get rid of, but still it remains. We still have some not approved therapies, interferon-free therapies for genotypes 4 through 6. And here in the Bay Area, we do see certainly a fair number of genotype 4 and 6, not too many genotype 5s. I think one of the challenges in the setting of transplantation is the issue of renal insufficiency. Sofosbuvir is not approved for use in individuals who have creatinine clearance is less than 30. And so in the patient on the wait list, for some of our post-transplant patients, that has been a challenge and has limited our use of the drug. And then finally, there were, up until recently, very few studies in decompensated cirrhotics. And that's a group of patients in which you might think we have the greatest need for such drugs. And the safety and efficacy data were relatively sparse, and that was also, I think, a limitation. But I would say the next sort of step forward, leaping forward, was the approval of soft lipisphere in October of this year. And this took us forward one more step. We're now down to one pill a day for our patients. Extremely good tolerability, and as I'll show you, we have data now in decompensated cirrhotics. It's a drug without any drug-drug interactions. Very high efficacy, as I'll show you. And in truth, this combination pill also offers lower cost compared to the cimiprivir-sofosbuvir combination that many of us were using over the past year, which I'll say was really a huge advantage for us in being able to use cimiprivir-sofosbuvir for treating our genotype 1 patients, and even though it was off-label at that time. Now, some of the negatives or things that I think we're still challenged with in terms of using sofosbuvir and lipisphere is it needs acid for absorption, so it requires careful education in terms of use with PPIs. And I think in a lot of our cirrhotic patients, most of them are on a PPI, often needing it. And so some carefulness about need for an acid environment for absorption is important. We still have the issue of the sofosbuvir not being approved in patients with creatinine clearances less than 30. And as I'll show you, we do have still some reduced SVR rates in patients with decompensated cirrhosis. But, you know, there's even more coming. I just got back from the SLD, as many of you did, and there were more than 300 abstracts were presented on hepatitis C therapies. So I am not going to try to cover that, you'll be happy to know. But just to give you a flavor that there are lots of other all-oral combinations coming. Some of them very soon we'll have available to us, others a little bit farther away. But within the next year or 18 months, you're going to see several other drug combinations for genotype 1. And also we're going to start to see options for some of our patients with genotype 3. That's actually been a bit of a challenge for us, genotype 3 patients, as well as those with genotypes 4 and 6. So really, in terms of thinking about hepatitis C, I would say that in terms of it being a disappearing disease, I'd say yes, it's probably going to disappear over time. The future looks extremely bright for the treatment options that we have available, both now, what we can work with now, and really for the future. But honestly, I would say that we still have some challenges. And I think the main one is that if you're going to eradicate a disease, if this disease is going to disappear, you have to treat everyone. And our biggest challenge right now is that most of the patients are undiagnosed. There has been nice data presented that show at least 50% of infected individuals in the United States still don't know they have the disease. Most of them are baby boomers, and that's the reason for the baby boomer advocating for baby boomer screening. And I'll point out to you that baby boomers are more likely to have cirrhosis. 25% of those baby boomers that are currently undiagnosed have cirrhosis. So we have many patients walking into the clinic, newly diagnosed through baby boomer screening, who are also presenting for the first time with cirrhosis. So if we're going to have inroads and have this disease disappear, we have to first and foremost identify the patients. And then there's challenges in terms of executing treatment. Gone are the concerns really about being able to treat, but I think now we have to kind of narrow it down to how do we do it well. Many of the patients are going to get sort of one shot at treatment. At least it looks like that for many of them right now. And you want to make a good choice for them in terms of giving them the right regimen for their profile, meaning the subgenotype, stage of disease, et cetera. You want to make sure that you give your patient the maximum chance for an SVR when you do treat. And as we move towards shorter and shorter treatment courses, the importance of adherence becomes more and more paramount. And in the past, we didn't, I think, spend so much time really emphasizing the importance of adherence, but I think it's now more important than ever. And while the traditional barriers to treatment in terms of comorbidities, you know, in the past, if patients had psychiatric comorbidities, if they had significant cardiopulmonary disease, treatment was off the table. Gone are really the barriers to really a patient being the barrier to treatment. There are very few patients that are not going to be really eligible for treatment. As long as they're adherent, they can be treated. But we have new barriers, and I think the biggest one is access and cost. And I think every one of us are challenged by the ability to get our patients the treatment that we would like to give them. So those are sort of the new challenges that we are now dealing with. So until these sort of major issues are dealt with, I don't think this disease is going to disappear. So one of the things that's happened is the ASLD IDSA guidelines came out with recommendations in terms of prioritization for treatment. This prioritization was really meant to help facilitate really who we should most quickly get into treatment. It was really reflecting the groups that were at the highest risk for complications in the absence of treatment. So not surprisingly, highest on the list were those with advanced fibrosis, organ transplant recipients, and those that had complications of cryoglobulinemia, most commonly the vasculitis and the membranoproliferative glomerulonephritis. They also come up with a sort of second list, which was high priority, and this gave it to patients that had F2 disease, HIV co-infection, HBV, NAFLD as coexisting liver diseases, listed some of the extrahepatic complications of hepatitis C, such as diabetes, porphyria cutanea tarda, and also included debilitating fatigue. These were not meant to be a list that restricted patients from getting access to treatment. It was really meant to facilitate those needing it most. But unfortunately, I think it has turned into a means of denying treatment. And I really just want to make a point to all of us as physicians that we need to advocate for our patients in terms of getting them treatment, recognizing that the prioritization should help us to identify those we need to move on most quickly. But truthfully, the guideline also specifically states that every patient really should be considered for treatment. And why? Well, HCV really, as you all know, is associated with a significant risk of both hepatic diseases, but increasingly we're recognizing the importance of extrahepatic diseases as causes of morbidity and mortality in our patients. And shown in this bar, this is the REVEAL study, which is this very large cohort from Taiwan, but I think instructive in terms of looking at the frequency of extrahepatic diseases. So, for example, if you look at the bar graph on the right, extrahepatic diseases, you know, such as diabetes, such as lymphoma, you will find them at approximately double the rate in patients who are HCV positive compared to patients who are HCV negative. So I think increasingly when you see a patient, it's not only thinking about a patient who might have low stage of liver disease, but thinking about how you might be preventing diabetes or preventing lymphoma or preventing other complications such as chronic renal disease, and that patient is also worth considering. Cure is really the best way to reduce the complications of disease. So shown here is data presented at the AASLD. There's been many publications, but I like this because it's a meta-analysis of over 129 studies that looked at more than 23,000 patients. And really, really makes the point that if we want to reduce mortality, we need to get SVR. And the group that's really benefits the most is, again, that group that has cirrhosis and those that are co-infected. But across the board, if you treat a patient, you can reduce their likelihood of dying by at least 50%. So our challenges going forward, as I highlighted, are really to identify all those individuals who should be treated. And I do believe that the prioritization should be used in a thoughtful manner, but recognizing that really every patient needs to be considered for treatment. Think about the extrahepatic complications and the benefits of curing HCV patients to reduce those risks as well. Clearly, the highest risk-benefit ratio is for those with advanced fibrosis and those with HIV co-infection. And really optimizing the algorithms for those with advanced disease is really going to be the focus of the remainder of my talk. So this is a transplant symposium, but in fact, I'm going to spend my time not talking about post-transplant treatment, but really treating the cirrhotic. Because I think that the cirrhotic patient are the patients that you're all dealing with, and I think where there's been a great explosion in terms of the therapeutics, and where I think now that we can treat really every patient that has cirrhosis, the question of how to do that treatment in the context of transplantation is worth considering. So I'll just point out that this is the guidelines as they currently exist, and I would just say to you that they're now obsolete, so really not helpful to us. They're going to put out a new guideline in December. I don't know what that guideline looks like, and this is just my best guess. And I really am not on the committee, so I can't really say if this is going to be the truth or not. But really, my point in putting it up there is that we now have several options available for compensated cirrhotics. You know, we have been using sofosbuvir, simipivir off-label, but just recently, this month, it now is an approved therapy for patients with genotype 1 infection. We also have sofosbuvir, which is approved with and without ribavirin. And then later, very soon, we're expecting the approval of the regimen of paritaprevir, which is a ritonavir-boosted PI with ombitisvir and dasabuvir. And then, of course, we still have sofosbuvir ribavirin, which is a drug that still is going to be the approved therapy, for example, for genotype 2 and probably genotype 3. I think where there's been probably the major advance from my point of view is now we have another therapy for our decompensated cirrhotics. So in the past, the only treatment we could offer these patients was sofosbuvir and ribavirin, and it was for this indefinite period. And truthfully, we didn't have any data about whether it worked or not. Now we have sofosbuvir as an option for our decompensated patients, and I'm going to share with you the data on those results. So there may be other things that are added on the list, and in terms of duration and whether you use ribavirin, I think those are going to be the interesting nuances of the guidelines. But let me take you through some of the new data that will help us kind of understand how the guidelines might have been informed by recent studies. In thinking about a patient with advanced liver disease, you're a patient with cirrhosis, I think you first have to know whether they're compensated or decompensated. It seems like an obvious thing, but this strongly influences your SVR rates. It's going to influence what drugs you choose, whether you can use ribavirin or should use ribavirin, and your treatment duration. And I think you have to think about what your goal of therapy is if you have a patient who's decompensated. Are you aiming to get them to get SVR so that you can reverse their decompensation and potentially avoid transplantation? Or are you just trying to get them HCV RNA negative so they can get into transplant and be free of hep C post-transplant? You have to know why you're treating, because I think it's going to influence how you approach it. We are still very enthusiastic about trying to prevent HCV infection among those individuals who are going to transplant. So if we have someone on the waiting list, certainly somebody who we know is going to get a transplant, such as those with a living donor or those who have hepatocellular carcinoma, we often like to time our treatment in concert with knowing when the transplant's going to occur. If you're treating a patient on the wait list and you're treating for SVR, I think you have to consider what the consequences of relapse will be. They may get a clinical decompensation in the setting of relapse, but most importantly, if they have relapse, they're going to have relapse with resistance. And what that means in the context of going forward through transplant, I don't think any of us really know. And then finally, in terms of thinking about treating a patient who's on the wait list, you have to consider the consequences in terms of the donor selection. So for example, if you have a patient who's HCV infected, they are still eligible to get an HCV infected donor. That might be a good thing for a patient who's anxious to get transplanted. If we cure them of their hepatitis C before transplant, that no longer is going to be an option, at least not in the short term. We're not considering that. On the flip side, though, we have had a donor age restriction for our Hep C patients up until now. So we used to say that if a patient was Hep C infected and went through transplant, we weren't going to let them have a donor that was over the age of 55. And the reason for that is because we knew that older donors had worse outcomes in our HCV infected patients. Now that we can cure more and more of those patients going into transplant, that is going to open up the option of older donors for those patients. So that might be a positive thing to consider. So all of these things really are coming very quickly to the foreground in terms of how we have to think about treating our patients who are on the waiting list. So let me share a little bit of data about sofosbuvir and simipivir. This has been a very sort of solid combination therapy that we have utilized really since the two drugs were available to us. Recently, it was approved by the FDA for treatment of genotype 1 infection. For those with no cirrhosis, 12-week recommended. For those with cirrhosis, 24 weeks, which I find interesting, actually, since most of us have been using 12-week therapy for our cirrhotic patients. This is a relatively simple therapy, 2 pills a day if you go without ribavirin, and it was approved for use without ribavirin. Same considerations that I've mentioned before in terms of sofosbuvir. The one thing I'll mention about simipivir, though, is that you do have to be very thoughtful about the level of hepatic impairment that you have in your patient. I personally would say that this is a drug that should be used in Child's A patients, even though it was approved for use in Child's A and B patients. But simipivir levels are increased in patients with hepatic impairment. They are increased, the levels of simipivir are increased 2.4 and 5.2-fold higher in Child's B and C patients respectively. It's actually not recommended in Child's C, and I would say you should be very cautious in the Child's B patient. These higher simipivir exposures have been associated with more AEs. Now, what sort of led to the approval of this drug for genotype 1 patients? Well, it was really the COSMOS data, which you all are very familiar with. And really, it was a very exciting study that really helped us a lot to understand how to use these drugs. And you can see here the success in this COSMOS studies, which included patients with F3-4 fibrosis. They were in treatment naive and nulls, total of 87 patients, and basically response rates over 90%. And really with no advantage shown in using ribavirin and no advantage in this study really specifically for those patients who received 12 versus 24 weeks of treatment. So at least in our practice over the past, 9 months really since we've had these drugs available, we have been using simipivir, sofosbuvir. I've been using some ribavirin, I have to be honest, for 12 weeks. And our data went into the HCV Target, which is a large consortium that's gathering data on really real-life practice, and they presented data at the AASLD. Here's the combination of sofosbuvir and simipivir with or without ribavirin in genotype 1 patients. I narrowed the data down to just those with cirrhosis. They had over 261 patients that had been treated. And you'll see that in a compensated cirrhotic that the SVR rate, this is SVR4, is 87%, so very close to the clinical trial data, which said it was 93%, so a little bit less. But really, I wanted to point out here the impact of having decompensated cirrhosis. So you can see there's a diminution, a decrease in the response rates. This is a theme you're going to see with every drug combination we have, and that is when you go from compensated to decompensated, we generally see a drop-off in the response rates of our patients. Here we're seeing about a 10 to maybe 15% decrease in the SVR rates in our decompensated patients. The other thing I'll point out is that as was highlighted in the COSMOS study, so too in the HCV Target study, they saw no advantage of using ribavirin in these patients. So this really truly does represent an interferon-free and a ribavirin-free treatment regimen. In terms of the adverse event profile with this soft-based therapy, and here I'm comparing soft ribavirin to the soft simiprevir data, basically the AEs are driven by ribavirin. So it really points out to the safety of both sofosbuvir and simiprevir in these patient populations. And really the adverse events are those related to using ribavirin, which really just speaks to the potential benefit, we would like to think, of getting rid of ribavirin from our treatment cocktails. But I will point out there's been some serious adverse events reported with the simiprevir-sofosbuvir therapy. They're very infrequent, and it's unclear to me if it's related to the treatment or just related to the fact that you're treating patients with advanced liver disease. But in HCV Target, they did report some deaths, 0.6% overall, and 9 of the 12 deaths were in cirrhotic patients. The Mayo Clinic reported their experience of 147 patients, and they had one death for a percentage of 0.7% of a patient who developed progressive liver failure 6 months post-treatment, and the patient had SVR. They also reported, and this is more my clinical experience, that we see some hyperbilirubinemia that's known to be a side effect of simiprevir. But in some cases, we see elevated levels over 3, and in the Mayo Clinic experience, all of those abnormalities were seen in patients who had cirrhosis and who had elevated bilirubin levels at baseline, perhaps speaking to the fact that individuals who are more into the Child's B category may be more at risk for this complication. And then finally, there was very recently a published report of 2 cases of decompensation in the setting of simiprevir-sofosbuvir treatment, and in this particular case report, they attributed the hepatotoxicity to simiprevir. So I think that we have to be just very cautious. These are not control data. So, and they're treating patients with cirrhosis, some of them with decompensation already. So I think understanding whether it's a drug effect or whether this is a effect of treating patients with advanced disease who would have had this complication anyway is unknown. But I think we just really want to be aware of the data. Now, I'm going to shift to sofosbuvir libtiofusvir. As I mentioned, this is the drug that was most recently approved, and these are some of the studies that led to its approval. These are the ION studies, ION 1 and 2, and really just to point out to you the very high SVR rates across the board. In the ION 1, there were about 17% of patients that had cirrhosis, and in ION 2, 20% of patients had cirrhosis. You can see the SVR rates range from 94 to 99%, so extremely high. And in this particular study, you can see that also we don't see any particular advantage with treating for 24 weeks or with using ribavirin. So let me go now to looking more at the cirrhotic population with this patient with this particular drug combination. This is the ION2 data now looking specifically at treatment experienced cirrhotics. Looking specifically at the cirrhotic patients and those that had been previously treated. And what we'll see here now when we start to drill down to the details is that in the group that has been previously treated and has cirrhosis, that we do see that there's a decrease in the SVR rates from the 95 to 100% range, which is what we saw before, to more being in the 82 to 86% range. So suggests that this group of patients, which has cirrhosis and has been previously treated, that group of patients may benefit from being treated for longer. Note again that in this particular study, they again didn't show that the ribavirin seemed to make a difference. So the recommendation sort of really, if you'd look at this data alone, would be in patients who are cirrhotic, most of them can be treated with 12 weeks of sofosbuvir libtiofusvir. But if you have a patient who's treatment experienced and cirrhotic, you'd want to treat them for 24 weeks. Now, at the recent ASLD meeting, we had a lot more data to sort of speak to this issue, and I have to say it really has strongly influenced my thinking about how we're going to treat our cirrhotic patients. So this was a safety and efficacy analysis of over 500 patients with compensated cirrhosis from Europe. They pooled, it was presented, and it really looked at the impact of duration of therapy and ribavirin on SVR rates. Now, what the bar graphs show here are the kind of SVR rates across the treatment groups. And really, let's just kind of focus on the treatment experienced group again. So what we see is very much what we saw in the most recent study, and that is that the sofosbuvir libtiofusvir for 12 weeks, so has an inferior or a lower, well, lower SVR rate, still in the 80s, than the groups that got 24 weeks of therapy and also lower than the group that got sofosbuvir libtiofusvir for 12 weeks with ribavirin. An interesting sub-analysis they did was to look at the effect of platelet count on SVR rates, and I think this is really interesting because it sort of points towards potentially a mechanism why we see the rates of response. Maybe it is related to the severity of portal hypertension, but you can see here that the patients who had platelet counts under 75, that their rates of response, particularly again in that treatment-experienced cirrhotic patient population, was 82% compared to higher rates of SVR in patients who had higher platelet counts. So the message really from this particular study is in this much larger cohort is that when we start to look again at the cirrhotic population, most of the patients do very well overall. We still have very high rates of response, but the group that's standing out as potentially needing something more is your group of patients that's treatment experienced and has cirrhosis. And again, in that group of patients, sofosbuvir ladipizafir for 12 weeks doesn't seem to be giving us the response rates we'd want, and it looks like soft ladipizafir plus ribavirin for 12 weeks or soft ladipizafir for 24 weeks gives you better SVR rates. And one of the most impressive studies I thought at the meeting that was presented was a study that tests that that issue exactly. So this is a treatment-experienced cirrhotic patient population. So what they did here is really a double-blind placebo-controlled study where they compared soft ladipizafir plus ribavirin for 12 weeks versus soft ladipizafir without ribavirin for 24 weeks. Sort of begging the question, is it the ribavirin that matters or the length of treatment that's more important? I want to point out that they really are studying the kind of patients that you're seeing. These were treatment experienced. Many of them had failed protease inhibitor therapies with first-generation PI. So you can see the baseline resistant variants that were present in 70 to 75% of the patients. The mean MELD score was 7, but the upper range went up to 16 in some patients. About 20% had varices. Many of them had platelet counts under 100. Albumins were low in a small percentage, and bilirubin levels were generally normal, but some up to 2.5. And here really is Oh, that didn't come out quite so well on the bottom. I'm sorry, it's a bit jumbled. But basically, you can say the two groups look the same. So the SVR rates was really the same and actually very high, as you can see here, 96 and 97% in the soft ladipizafir plus ribavirin for 12 weeks, as well as in the soft ladipizafir without ribavirin for 24 weeks. So I think that sort of answers the question to my mind of how I might treat my patient who has treatment experience and is genotype 1 with cirrhosis. I can either use triple therapy for three months or 12 weeks, or if I don't think the patient can tolerate ribavirin, then I would go with soft ladipizafir for 24 weeks. Now, the other thing I'm going to point out, because I think it's an important issue, is how do they do if they have these baseline resistant variants? So these patients had been previously treated with a protease inhibitor, and you can see that the success in terms of their SVR rates, really it's not impacted by the presence of these resistant variants. And then the other important aspect of this study is really it's one of the few placebo control trials that we have that tell us about the safety of sofosbuvir and ladipizafir. So if you focus on the two red boxes, the placebo group is shown in the first box and then the ladipizafir soft is shown in the other box to the right. The bottom line is this is a very safe drug in that we don't see really any difference in terms of the total number of AEs or serious AEs in the patients that receive soft ladipizafir versus the placebo control patients. And this is very important to see in a patient that has cirrhosis and is prone to getting AEs anyway. You can see that overall the AE rate's 80%, but really no difference between those that got drug versus those that were untreated or received the placebo. So really, I think, speaks to the safety of soft ladipizafir in this group of cirrhotic patients. And then finally, the SOLAR study, which is an important study. We were fortunate enough to participate in this study, and it's looking at patients with more advanced liver disease. So now we're going from the Child's A patients, which were predominantly the study I just showed you, to now looking at patients with Child's B and C cirrhosis. This was a study in genotype 1 and 4 patients, and here again we were treating patients either with the triple therapy of soft ladipizafir plus ribavirin for 12 weeks or with soft ladipizafir without ribavirin for 24 weeks. Again, what you can see is that overall and by Child's Pugh score, there is no difference between the two groups. Again, reinforcing that these are both good options for us in terms of treating our patients with cirrhosis. And I'll also point out in these patients with Child's BC cirrhosis that we're getting SVR rates that are approaching 90% across the board. And the other really important aspect of the SOLAR study is it really helped us to understand what can we expect to see in our patients who were responding to treatment. So we have these very high SVR rates. What's happening in terms of these more advanced liver disease patients in terms of their MELD scores? So shown on the bars on the right are the patients' change in MELD score as they go through treatment. The Child B patients are shown in the fourth set of bars, Child C on the second set. Those that have the blue bars are patients who MELD scores decreased, and you can see the patients had a decrease in MELD score from 1 to 4 points, and the majority of patients enjoyed such an improvement. There were a few patients who actually progressed and a few that didn't have any change. I think what we really need to do going forward is understand which are the patients that are going to get the improvement in their MELDs and which are not, because that might help us to decide who we should treat. But I think really this is very, very important data to help us understand the potential to reverse decompensation in the patients that we take through treatment. So to summarize, sevasemir lidipasvir in patients with cirrhosis, I think this is a drug that offers a lot of advantages for our patients with Child's A, B, and C cirrhosis. I think it's really ideal for the pre-transplant population. I think we're seeing that there are some subgroups that have lower SVR rates. Certainly the treatment experience group appears to be one in which we can expect the treatment response rates may be lower, but we can improve those, I think, by adding ribavirin to the mix and potentially extending treatment duration. I think this idea about the platelet count and the role of portal hypertension in terms of predicting response to therapy and potentially reversibility of cirrhosis will be, I think, an ongoing area that we need to study. But for me, I think that these studies were really quite critical in helping me to understand how I'm going to treat my patient. I think the addition of ribavirin improves the SVR rates and allows you to use 12 weeks of treatment, and I think that's a very cost-effective option. But clearly, if you have a patient who can't tolerate ribavirin, then you need to treat for 24 weeks with sevasemir and lidipasvir. The improvements in liver function tests and the MELDs that we see, more than 50% of the patients were seeing improvements within 12 weeks of being on treatment. This is a very rapid improvement. And this is just the beginning. My guess is if we were to follow those patients for 6 months, a year, that we'd see further improvements in terms of their MELD and their CPT scores. Now, I'm just going to make a few mentions about the other therapies that we're expecting maybe a little bit later, and I'm going to really confine my remarks to the paritaprovir, which is ritonavir boosted, ombitisvir, and asabivir with or without ribavirin. And that's because this drug therapy is also anticipated soon. It'll come to you before we have another opportunity to review, before you see me next year. This is going to add to the armamentarium of genotype 1 patients. In particular, I'm going to focus on the cirrhotics. We don't have data really in the decomp group yet, so I would say this is not a drug combination that we would use in that patient population. It's a boosted PI, so you're sort of back to the issue of managing drug-drug interactions, so you're going to have to be mindful of that when you use this drug combination. And I'm going to share with you some data that suggests that there is a differential with respect to the subgenotype when you're treating the genotype 1 patients. I'll just mention that, you know, I'm not going to talk about these data, but we're very interested in finding new therapies for genotype 3, for example. We do need an all-oral regimen for genotypes 4, 5, and 6 that should be approved, and we're hopeful to have those, hopefully, with next iteration of therapies coming forward. So just to give you a sense of what this I'm going to call it the 3D combo because that's what it often goes by. So this is a boosted PI, NS5A inhibitor, and a non-nuke. And so what you see here is, again, for 12 and 24 weeks of treatment, now I'm giving you cirrhosis data, okay, because I like to stick with that pain population, I think the more difficult to treat. You'll see here that 36 of these patients in this study were previous null responders. What you see is that overall, again, very high rates of SVR, over 90%, 92% specifically in the group that got 12 weeks, and 96% in those that got 24 weeks. At the recent ASLD meeting, they reanalyzed these data, which have already actually been published, but they reanalyzed it with a view to understanding what are the groups that influence the sustained virological responses. And I think it's informative because it helps to sort of hone in for us on who are the more difficult to treat patient populations when we have these highly effective therapies. And what they showed in their multivariate analysis is that IL-28B genotype actually had an influence. If you were a TT, your SVR rate was 81% versus if you're a non-TT, it was 94%. Prior NEL response, that's a very common theme. We saw that with soft lidipasvir as well, that was an influencing factor. And the other thing that I'm going to focus on is the difference by subgenotype. So genotype 1A had a lower response rate than individuals with genotype 1B. Speaking further to this point, this is a very busy slide, and I tried to get it really onto one. Again, this is our 3D combo. It's a pooled analysis from their phase 3 trials, but it's looking at it now by subgenotype, so the 1As are on the left, 1Bs are on the right. And really, the point here in showing this is that across the board, the bars kind of look the same. But there is one group in which the response rates do appear to be lower, and that is the group that's 1A cirrhotic null responder. That's a group with indicated by the arrow, which I would say that needs for sure the 24 weeks of treatment. All of the other groups, especially across 1Bs, we see very consistent results, and you can see they tend to be higher than the 1As. They're sort of 95 to 100%. It really works very, very well in a 1B patient. But in the 1As, we are seeing a differential, and again, a differential particularly in the patient who's a null responder. So just to kind of highlight this, this is, I think, data you'll see more of, and just to be cognizant that some of the therapies are going to have subgenotype differences. So my last few slides are really about thinking again about the waitlisted patients in view of all of this new data related to how we treat our cirrhotic patients. So I don't have the answer, but I think whenever I am thinking about putting a patient on treatment, this is what I kind of go through in my head. So to treat a patient prior to liver transplant, if we eradicate the hep C before they go, you know, eradicate it so that post-transplant they are hep C free, that definitely simplifies our post-transplant management. I don't have to worry about any drug-drug interactions with the immunosuppressive drugs. And in the patients, if they're early enough, we may be able to actually reverse their decompensation and avoid liver transplant entirely, and that would be an amazing save. They don't need a transplant. And even for those that don't avoid transplant, you may, if with SVR, improve their quality of life while they're waiting for a transplant, make their encephalopathy better, make their ascites more manageable. So I think there's some very strong reasons to think about treating patients while they're on the waiting list. On the flip side, you could choose to treat nobody on the waiting list, and you could just treat them all after transplant. And I didn't go through with you the data about treating post-transplant with these new drug therapies, but I'm going to tell you they're all excellent. And indeed, what I would actually say about post-transplant treatment of hep C is that it's almost as if the playing field has been leveled. They respond the same as patients who've not had transplants. So we have excellent results. It's not difficult to treat patients after transplant. We do have more drug-drug interactions to worry about, and that can be a bit of a management issue. But overall, I think this is a very reasonable thing, is that we could treat people after transplant. The problem I have about, I call it MEL purgatory. So let me explain to you what MEL purgatory is. So what I'm concerned about is actually the patient on the wait list, and maybe I'll go to my next slide. I think I sort of outline it on this slide. It's very obvious to me that the patient who's Child's A and low MELD, that if you treat them and you get SVR, you're probably going to prevent a transplant in many cases. You may not be able to prevent cancer, but you're going to reverse the complications. They're going to do well. It's also pretty clear to me that somebody who's Child's C, who has got a very high MELD, that they need a transplant. And so I'm not sure we need to worry about treating them. We should probably just get them transplanted. And if we're going to do any treatment at all, our treatment should be focused on trying to just do short treatment to try to prevent recurrence, but not really aiming to get SVR. The Child C patients, they need a transplant. Let's just get them transplanted. I think the problem group is the Child B, and this is where clearly we have drugs now that we could use in Child B patients. I just showed you the data with sofladipsfir. It's a very good option. We know the SVR rates are going to be 85 range, so that's very, very high. We're going to make them better. I showed you the MEL scores go down, so we're going to reverse liver complications in many. We may be able to reduce waitlist mortality by treating patients who might have had a complication and died in the absence of getting a transplant. But what I worry about is that you're going to treat them, they're going to get better, but not better enough. And then they're going to be stuck with their refractory encephalopathy, but have SVR, and therefore will not ever get sick enough to get a transplant, and they're going to have to basically sort of be stuck. So I think what we're sort of challenged by in terms of thinking about treating the patients with sort of medium MELs is which ones are going to get better so we can avoid transplants and which ones are not going to get better enough and should really just move forward to transplant, and we should maybe hold off on treating those patients. These are like the big questions that we need to answer with much, much more data in the days going forward. I'm just going to go back and just give you an example here of how we've been thinking about the treatment of patients on the waitlist, just to really kind of hone in on our thinking. So let's take the first case, a patient whose child B has mild hepatic encephalopathy, it's controlled, has HCC, and has mild exception points now at 27. That patient, we can pretty much know when he's going to get to high enough on the list for us to initiate the treatment just in time. Currently, that patient, we're choosing the strategy at the bottom, which is we start their antiviral therapy within 6 to 12 weeks of when we think they're going to get their transplant, our goal being to get them to be undetectable for at least 4 weeks and then take them through transplant. One could argue that now that we have very, very highly effective therapies, we might start a little bit early and we'll be close to SVR by that time. But the idea is being those individuals we know are going to go to transplant, so we can time everything to make sure that we actually get the virus where we want it before transplant. So that's easy. We're going to treat that patient. The one on the far side, child C patient, who's got moderate to severe hepatic encephalopathy, doesn't have cancer, has a MELD of 29, blood type A, that patient I may not treat. I may just let that patient go forward to transplant. He needs, most importantly, to get transplanted, and then we'll deal with the hep C post-transplant. That's very straightforward for us. And then there's that one in the middle, which I'm not sure what I'll do, but many of them will be treated, I think. I think we're going to be compelled. I think we're going to have drugs, we're going to want to treat them, and we're going to be worried that if we don't treat them, they might die of a complication of the liver disease. So I think we're going to treat, but I think we are going to learn very quickly the patients who are going to get reversibility of their disease and actually do well, and others that actually will get somewhat better, but not better enough. So with that, I'm actually not going to show you these last slides because time is getting on. I just want to actually give you my very last slide, which is this one. And that is to just point out that this is an amazing time. I've been using the slide forever. I think I write review articles and I use it a lot. And for a long time, I had hardly any drugs to put on the on the diagram. And now we're really at a position where we have many drugs, both pre-transplant. There's some very exciting stuff that we're doing peri-transplant with hepatitis C immune globulin. And we're actually also going to be embarking upon a study of soft lipidosphere in the immediate post-transplant phase. So some very exciting stuff happening there. And then we've got very good options for post-transplant as well. So just to point out, this diagram just keeps getting the list now bigger and bigger each time I give the talk. But really, from the point of view of transplantation, I think an amazing time for our patients, many of them to do exceptionally well in the setting of this hep C therapeutics that we now can offer. And thanks. I just want to, you know, and before I close, just acknowledge, you know, we do a lot of hep C treatment at UCSF, and I can't do it without really a team. In particular, the advanced practitioners who work with me, Ileana, Lisa, and Stephanie, really manage the pre- and post-transplantation patients in large part with this really a hands-on approach. And my colleagues, Jen, Jenny, and Stephanie, and Monica, who's not here, but just to let you know that it's a big group of people who are taking care of the hep C patients, and I just want to acknowledge their help and their support. Thanks. I'm like standing between you and a glass of wine. I know.
Okay, we only have time for a few questions. Eddie, head back.
Sure. Yeah, okay. Okay. All right, so the question is, what's sort of the role for FibroScan in terms of making treatment decisions? And I think FibroScan has kind of moved to the forefront of the way to assess for stage of disease or severity of fibrosis, and I think it's in many places replacing a biopsy. I think it's, if you have access to it, I think it's a very good option. And I think in our practice now, we tend to do the serum fibrosis marker, like a FibroSure fibro test, and the FibroScan. If they're concordant, then we feel pretty confident that that's probably where the patient's at and make our treatment decisions based on those results. And increasingly, we're also finding the insurers, because we do need to get our drugs approved, are accepting non-invasive tests as a way to assess stage of disease. So I think that's a very patient-friendly, provider-friendly approach, and I think the number of patients who need liver biopsy to stage their disease is going to diminish and probably disappear. I think I was trying to tell you I don't know. I have to say that I think you have to look carefully at the patient. patient's complications of liver disease. So I actually think the patient who's a Child's B and it's primarily biochemically abnormal, like their liver synthetic function is driving their B status, I think those patients are the ones most likely to get reversal and do very, very well. The patient I'm worried about who's Child's B, who has actually pretty severe portal hypertension, you know, refractory ascites, and then they're Child's B, or that is a patient that I'm worried you're going to cure them, but their portal hypertension, because it's based on that sort of fixed fibrosis, may not reverse. I don't know for sure. Certainly, if we draw from our Hep B experience, we all saw patients had really advanced decompensated liver disease reverse and really come back to be compensated. And I'm hopeful we're going to see the same thing with Hep C. But I think it's the Child's B patient with sort of severe portal hypertensive complications is the one I'm less certain about in terms of reversibility. But ones where it's primarily synthetic dysfunction, I think those patients will probably do very well, and I would advocate to treat those ones especially, because I think they'll probably do well. We've got good drugs now, I think, safe drugs, and I think they have a good chance they'll reverse to the point of not needing a transplant. Those ones I would treat as soon as I sort of decide that as soon as I can get the drugs, basically. No, I would not time that one. That would be a patient as soon as I sort of decide that I've got the patient in my office, they're in that category of patient I'd like to treat, I would just treat them. No need to time that one in terms of transplant, okay? Because you're going to treat for SVR there. And remember that if you use soft ladipizivir plus ribavirin, it could be a 12-week treatment course, right?
Okay.
I don't know. That's the short answer. No, you know, we're all concerned about sort of, you know, as a physician and an advocate for my patient, you know, there are many patients that I see that are not cirrhotic or not advanced fibrosis, sort of fitting into that highest priority group. I really want them to be treated. It's a burden for patients to carry a diagnosis of Hep C. It impacts them in many, many ways. I think everybody should be treated. That's my sort of bottom line. But the reality is that we're having to work within a system where there is a barriers to getting the drugs. And it is possible that as more drugs come into the market, that the cost will go down. So I think that's possible. So a non-cirrhotic patient could potentially wait for that. But I think you have to really think about the patient first and foremost. And think about not just what is their stage of disease, but think about, you know, how is the disease impacting them? Do they have any extrahepatic manifestations? I mean, I think it's the full picture. It shouldn't be just like, what is their F stage, right? That shouldn't be the primary thing that just kind of is a yes, no. It should be really a more composite look at the patient.
Last question.
Well, we have a few relapsers. So the question is what to do about relapses with the new therapies. Well, we could go through each of the specific therapies, but the patients that get exposed to a protease inhibitor and relapse will have protease inhibitor resistance mutations. Anybody who's on an NS5A inhibitor and gets and relapses will have NS5A resistant variants. We believe they don't stick around forever. We have pretty good data from kind of our first generation PIs that over time they disappear. So it's not like it'll be forever there. And it doesn't look like from the data we have that it interferes with actually another round of treatment as long as you have another drug that's going to be effective against those resistant variants. So we already have those data. So I don't think you should like burn a lot of bridges, but I do think that there's not going to be a lot of limitations there. I think we're going to have to be thoughtful about what the next course of therapy is for that patient, but we already have data that says it doesn't actually limit kind of their success with being retreated. That's the short answer.
Okay. Thanks very much for a wonderful talk, Nora.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.